The next case is 95-1239, James Young versus the Morning Journal.
Justice, Associate Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Richard Panza, and I'm from Lorain. I represent the Morning Journal. To the extent that I have any time left, I'd like to reserve for rebuttal. The publication of the Morning Journal, published on July 20th, 1992, is protected under Ohio law for three reasons. The first is that it is a substantially accurate reproduction of the public record and therefore privileged under 2317.05 of the Ohio Revised Code. The second is that it is protected under a privilege recognized by a number of courts of appeals in the state of Ohio, but never fully recognized by this court, in that it is protected under the doctrine of neutral reportage. Last and not least of which is important, appellants maintain that the appellee is in fact a public figure.
And who wouldn't be a public figure?
I'm not a public figure.
You're not a public figure, but he is.
Absolutely. Absolutely he is. But then I wasn't, for the last 17 years, head of the special agent in charge of the drug task force in Lorain County. I have not had the prominence of having close to 100 newspaper articles written about my activities. Some of those are articles going into his personal beliefs, his personal
habits. If you do good works and you're active in your church and you lead some formal benefit for children and the newspaper decides to do a feature story on you with a nice photograph on a Sunday morning edition of the good works that you've been doing in the community over a lifetime, does that then make you a public figure because you've said nothing about this?
Well, of course, Justice Piper, it's a question of extent. To the extent of your good works, if they are notorious throughout the community, then I would suggest to you yes, that probably would make you a public figure. It probably would directly contribute to your ability to impact through those good works throughout your community. Absolutely. It may make you a public figure, although it...
How about the bag lady or the bird lady who hangs out around the courthouse and everybody who's important knows her? She's been a town character.
Definitely.
I'm going to run the risk of saying that she wouldn't be a public figure, unless a great deal had been written about her her activities over 20-25 years.
Is whether you're a public figure or not a question of fact or a question of law?
Unquestionably a question of law.
The trial court sort of dodged that, didn't it?
She absolutely did, Your Honor. Yes, Judge McGuff did dodge that question. But then Judge McGuff found in favor of the newspaper in regards to 2317.05 and probably simply didn't feel it necessary to address that particular issue at that time.
Is it necessary?
Was it necessary at that time?
Yes.
No, I don't think so.
Is it necessary now?
Absolutely.
Why?
It's necessary now simply because, first of all, it was necessary in the Court of Appeals. I believe the Court of Appeals should have reviewed the record, and although it may not agree with Judge McGuff in regards to her conclusions in regards to 2317.05, I believe she had a duty, the Court of Appeals had a duty, to examine the record to determine whether or not Judge McGuff's ruling could be sustained on any other grounds. The Court of Appeals dodged the record, or dodged the issue too, by remanding it back to the trial court.
The Court of Appeals didn't rule on that issue at all.
Not at all.
Well, why do you say we have to rule on it? If we were to find 2317.05, that there's a privilege and or the neutral reporting doctrine, you never get to it.
I don't think you would ever get to it.
Well, I think that's what Justice Sweeney was asking.
I'm sorry, Justice Sweeney. I'll be more than satisfied for the court to concede that the publication is substantially accurate under 2317.05. It's unfortunate, I think, the neutral reportage doctrine.
Before you go to that, let's stay with 2317.05. Does the adding of the word Amherst distinguish this from Oney?
I would argue absolutely not. And I would simply point out to the court that that the result in Oney would have been identical if, in fact, there was a Michael Stoney Oney. If the court will remember, there wasn't a Michael Stoney Oney.
I remember.
I know you do. But if there had been a Michael Stoney Oney, it would have been the identical case that we have that the court has in front of it right now. But I believe the principle would have been the same, that the essence of the article was that Michael Oney was indicted. The essence of this publication is that James Young was held in contempt. We don't dispute the fact that...
Didn't the majority really rely on the fact that it was indeed accurate that Michael Oney, with his date of birth and his age and his address, was indeed the person who was indicted and brought to the sheriff's office, albeit a mistake, but it was the right fellow, whereas here, I agree with Justice Sutter that that's the question, whether the adding of Amherst under a privilege that says thou shalt use the official record and then thereby be privileged, that wasn't in the official record.
Well, first of all, Justice Cook, you're absolutely correct. The Supreme Court did dwell on the fact that, in fact, Michael Oney was, in fact, indicted in the Oney case. And I think that's one of the problems with the Court of Appeals analysis. They rely too much on the fact of Oney rather than the syllabus of Oney, which puts forth the real law in Ohio for determining whether or not the privilege of 2317.05 applies. And the syllabus of Oney requires us to go to the essence of the article to determine whether or not it's substantially inaccurate. As perceived by the ordinary reader, not as perceived by the James Young from Amherst, but as perceived by the ordinary reader, it's an objective test. And I submit to the court that the inclusion of the word Amherst, when viewed by the ordinary reader, is in fact nothing more than a minor inaccuracy. It's certainly not a minor inaccuracy to James Young from Amherst, but that's not the test.
But if he's a public figure because he's in the papers all the time, James Young from Amherst, and yeah, James Young is a fairly common name, if you just read the newspaper and read James Young, whether it's in Lorraine or Columbus or Bucyrus, you wouldn't be sure which James Young, but when you say James Young from Amherst, wouldn't it click with the average? It seems to me your two arguments on the two different prongs run headlong into each other. It is important, isn't it, that this is James Young from Amherst, because to these readers who have read all about this public figure, that's the James Young they know. Well, the James Young.
But the point is, just Piper, that the public record didn't designate where James Young was from. If in fact you had removed the word Amherst, I submit to you that the ordinary reader of Lorain County would have thought it was the James Young of Amherst. But then you would have had a publication that was 100% accurate. And the only reason I'm pointing that out is because I think it exemplifies the point I'm trying to make, that the essence of the public record, the thrust of what was on the public record, was the fact that James Young was held in contempt.
But the public record did, because if you look at the pleadings in the case, you could identify the address of the attorney in the case. I mean, it may not have been the contempt order, but it was another pleading in the very file in which they got the contempt order.
Well, I think that's expanding. I don't disagree with the point. I think what you're saying is that the reporter in some way had a duty to go beyond the docket and pull out the file and see the address. where the address of where the attorney was from. I don't believe the law requires that. I don't believe the law requires that kind of investigation. I believe it's the Wheat case holds that the reporter need not go beyond the public record that he or she is using for the source. But I don't doubt. I think if she had waited for Mr. Young's return call, if Mr. Young ever intended to recall, she could have figured it out. The point is, she was never in doubt. Not for one second was she in doubt of who the James Young was. She was just wrong.
But you're saying, on one hand, she wasn't required to go to the record and verify an address. On the other hand, it was okay if she put up her own address and made it up and put it in the article. Is that what you're saying?
I'm sorry. You're talking about the use of the word Amherst.
Yes.
All I'm really saying, Justice Stratton, is that the inclusion of the word Amherst doesn't take away from the essence of the public record, and that is that James Young was held in contempt, and James Young was held in contempt. It just wasn't the James Young from Amherst.
Why don't you just concede Justice Piper's point and say he is a public figure, then there's got to be actual malice.
Well, I didn't think that was the question
the
Justice was asking me, but certainly I think he's a public figure.
He says you're arguing on one hand he's a public figure. If he's a public figure, then everybody knows who he is, so therefore you have a greater burden.
Well, absolutely right. In fact, the notoriety is the thing that brought Ms. Allen to the attention of Mr. Young begin with.
I want to go to another issue. I'd like to get to the initial issue. Because it seems like there wasn't a checking on that, but this court has never adopted the neutral reportage doctrine, although some of us have come close. Could you discuss that briefly?
Absolutely. The neutral reportage doctrine is a doctrine first adopted by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in the Edwards versus National Audubon case. It is a principle which expands the public records doctrine and provides that reporters have the right to republish allegations made by prominent organizations, even where they may have some suggested doubt that the allegation may be false, as long as they believe in good faith that they are accurately republishing the accusation.
Okay, now let's stop there. You said republish publications made by, get your words right, substantial organizations or organizations of substance. Does it have to be that? Or can't they pick it up from the bag lady?
No, I think it has to be that. I think the source of the information has to be from a prominent source. I think the matter has to be one of public interest. And I believe that the test of accuracy is the reporter's belief that he's republishing the accusations correctly.
So if I'm not a substantial source, as you define it, and I surreptitiously record a cellular telephone conversation, and I somehow publish that or print it, and your newspaper picks it up and prints it, you're liable. You don't get the privilege or the protection of the neutral reporters.
Let me just say that I would not be able to argue that particular publication is protected by the neutral reportage doctrine. That's correct.
So you are saying a condition precedent for you claiming neutral reportage doctrine is that it must come from a substantial source.
Without question.
All right. Now, are you saying the substantial source was the court record?
Absolutely. And in fact,
even though you didn't report it accurately.
Absolutely. And Justice Douglas, I'm not the only one who says that. Justice Resnick said it in the April versus Reflector case, where the source there was the sheriff, the county sheriff. The Horvath case is another court of appeals case that has held that there's a neutral reportage rule. The source there are two assistant attorney generals of the state of Ohio.
There's a distinction that Justice Douglas made that in those cases, there's no question but that the reporting of the rumor of the whatever from the source was reported as given from the source, which is why I think, that's not really, when the mutual reportage doesn't seem to be an alternative grounds for relief here, if you can prevail on the your first ground, which is that it was substantial, the privilege.
Your Honor, I really have to tell you on behalf of my client, I don't care which issue I've been on. However, the reason why neutral reportage is so important here, and I believe it's an incredibly important principle for newspapers throughout the state, and the key with the analysis under neutral reportage, and I believe that it answers someone else's question concerning accuracy, is the test for accuracy in neutral reportage is subjective. It's the reporter's belief that she is accurately conveying the allegations that were made. That's the reason that's where the Court of Appeals went astray. They said, well, it's not substantially accurate under 23-1705, it's not substantially accurate under neutral reportage. Absolutely wrong. The 23-1705 test is an objective, ordinary reader test. The neutral reportage test is, in fact, a subjective test, which goes to the heart of whether or not the reporter felt at the time that she was accurately conveying the public record. And I think those are the distinctions.
How far do you... How much rope do you give a reporter in that area? You hear your reporter saw this court record, and she made a leap of faith that she knew the James Young that was involved without looking as into the rest of the file to see what the name and address, or what the address and the Supreme Court number, all of those things that you have to file about the case were sort of damning occurrence here. Can you just make it go? What if it had been a rape charge? Could she just make them against James Young? Could she just make a leap of faith that, hey, I know of James Young and he's prominent in our community, must be him?
First of all, Justice Piper, I don't think it was such a leap of faith. When you've written, when you only have knowledge of one James Young practicing law in Lorain County and you've written countless articles about him, I don't think it is such an incredible leap of faith to think that when you see something on the docket that concerns James Young, it is the one you know. To the extent that how far does it go, I believe it goes as far as the accusation permits, if in fact it is from a prominent source.
Let me give you an example. I was just reading information on lawyers who haven't done their continuing education. I found I forget the first name, but the middle name was Thomas and the last name was Moyer.
I saw that too.
I did too. Leap of faith that the Chief Justice was involved. I looked at that and said, yeah, there must be another Tom Moyer admitted to practice.
And so John Thomas.
John Thomas Moyer.
John Thomas Moyer.
Are you asking me to comment on that particular?
Yes, I mean you don't just look at something and make those kind of assumptions.
Well, I think that the law has to permit the free flow of ideas and the free flow of news in the state have to permit certain minor inaccuracies. Minor inaccuracies, as long as the essence of what being as long as the substantial accuracy of what's being said comes through to the public, I think that is the rule. I think if, in fact, there's an excellent source which says Tom Moyer hasn't completed his CLE credits, and I may be butchering your example here, but if, in fact, that's true, and if, in fact, I certainly think that's a matter of public interest, and I think that might be fair game.
Wouldn't a minor inaccuracy be more in the nature of burglar was wearing a ski mask when burglar was not, rather than burglar was John Young of Amherst when that wasn't reflected?
Not to the ordinary reader. I maintain that use of the word Amherst meant nothing to the ordinary reader. What meant everything to the ordinary reader is that just James Young was held in contempt. And I think that's where we make a mistake. I think what we have to do is sit back and we say, what does the inaccuracy, if in fact minor, mean to the ordinary reader? I submit to you that the use of the word Amherst was a minor inaccuracy that would have meant nothing to the ordinary reader. to the extent that, that people knew James Young, if you would remove the word, they still would have thought it was James Young. To the extent that they didn't know James Young, they wouldn't have, it would be, using the word Amherst wouldn't have concerned them one way or another.
Why would you not have published the correction in the same manner as, for purposes of argument, the misrepresentation? I mean, that's what the statute requires. And, you know, some must have been affected by this. I suppose that's the reason you're getting grilled by it. You get this big story. In fact, the First Lady last night said, a lie travels halfway around the world today before the truth can even be uttered. Now, well, you had this big article that James Young was, in fact, it's the headline is even, it's just the one rap, something with regard to rap. And then, when it comes time to say, oh, we got the wrong person, you put a little thing that says correction.
Well, you know, Justice Douglas, facts or copy machines play tricks on the eyes. The original article was on page B7. The correction that was printed 2 days later dealt with the inaccuracy. It dealt with the inaccuracy, the only inaccuracy of the article. The only inaccuracy in that article was used the word.
What page was that on?
What page is what on?
It's a correction. You're making B7 as being back buried in the paper.
It was in a like or similar location. But the correction specifically dealt with the inaccuracy of the original article. I mean, I've often wondered, you often run the risk with corrections of republishing the libel. And so you have to, corrections, you have to be very careful with corrections. But this correction, Justice Douglas, dealt with the only inaccuracy in the article, and that is use of the word Amherst. And it clearly pointed out that the James Young cited for contempt was James Young from Cleveland and not James Young from Amherst.
Yeah.
Which I would have thought would clear up the issue totally.
Yeah, I have a feeling about that too, that the fact that you're willing to run a correction, that's more than we usually get. But that statute, you say you run the risk of publishing it again, that statute is so very specific. In the same manner, almost it says, in the same location, the same way, as you're proving the original error. That wasn't done here.
I would,
I looked at the article. My eyes didn't play tricks.
No.
Maybe they did, but they're sure.
Well, you're certainly correct, Justice Douglas, you're certainly correct that the correction bore no headline. Other than the use of the word correction.
Whatever that is.
But it certainly did point out the inaccuracy, and it made the correction 2 days after, and I would maintain, Justice Douglas, in a like or similar location to where the original article appeared. So I don't think we have any problem with 2739.13. And by the way, we never, ever received a request for a retraction under 2739.15. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Panza. Mr. Ruff.
Chief Justice, honorable members of this court, my name is Mark Roof. I'm representing the plaintiff appellee, James Young. Despite all of the appellant's arguments, the appellant cannot explain away the fact that there was a misidentification in this case. That misidentification was due to the erroneous inclusion of information which was not in the court record. Under these circumstances, there should be liability. In determining whether liability applies, you must first look to 2317.05 as to whether there's a privilege. Under that statute, the privilege applies if a report is a fair and impartial report that has been judicially determined to be interpreted to require a substantially accurate report.
Did you depose any of the people who allege or that your client alleges left his practice because of this publication?
No, I was not the lawyer in the case.
Isn't that the proof of the pudding? Isn't this really much ado about nothing? In fact, he says that he couldn't draw leases anymore for somebody because they saw this publication, that he was in another municipal court, I think, and some lawyer looked over at him and said, hey, you gotten out of trouble with Judge McGuff yet? And he had three or four of those examples, but no place in the record could I find where it substantiated damage.
Well, aren't you making a credibility determination of whether the statements by James Young were true or false? And that's improper in ruling on a summary judgment motion.
Well, no. Now, let's not leave that. As a matter of fact, we've said time and again in the Grau case and in several of the cases, Kleinschmidt, several of the others, that when we're reviewing a First Amendment issue, we review it as though it was de novo. Isn't that true?
That's true. It is an issue of law.
So if that's the case, it is proper for me to review it on summary judgment, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so that's different than what you said. So now let's go to it. Besides that, the trial court ruled for the Morning Journal here.
Correct.
So the review is really of the Court of Appeals decision based on the reversal of the trial court's summary judgment.
Right, and the Court of Appeals held that, in essence, a misidentification is not a substantially accurate report. Therefore, the privilege does not apply.
Where the misidentification resulted from extra record, adding extra record information. I mean, that's the only syllabus that we're dealing with. So you could, I guess you would agree that you could have a, if they hadn't added any information and it never showed up as inaccurate, that it was James Young, would you think the newspaper was liable then?
No, I don't think there would be any liability if they had just put James Young in the article without the word Amherst. It was the word Amherst that misidentified the attorney held in contempt of court.
What if they said James Young, prominent attorney?
Well, I guess that would be dependent on whether the attorney was a prominent attorney or not, if that was a true or false statement.
That wasn't in the record, though.
No, it was not in the record.
So, doesn't the privilege apply to things that information you receive from a record?
That's correct, or essentially accurately portraying what's in the record, not adding extra information which misidentifies the person.
Wasn't the middle initial used in the court record?
Yes, it was. It was James C. Young, and the plaintiff is James H. Young.
Yes. And you just said that Amherst is the problem. You've abandoned your argument regarding the middle initial?
No, I haven't abandoned it. Essentially, the misidentification occurred by adding the extra word Amherst and deleting the middle initial. That's the argument that I raised in the brief. It was bold.
Did you raise any argument about the issue that Justice Douglas raised? I was interested in that too, about the requirement of the defendant has refused and neglected to publish in the same manner in which the publication appeared, complaint appeared, reasonable written explanation. Did you challenge that at all, the way in which the correction was published?
Yes, I did. I made that argument in the brief, and that's why I attached the full page of each article.
Court of Appeals didn't seem to anything with that.
No, they did not address that issue. That's correct.
What about this? Do you see the test for application of the privilege and the neutral reportage doctrine to be the same test of accuracy?
Well,
for the appellate here suggests that there is a different test for accuracy.
I think it is a different test. However, I don't think the neutral reportage doctrine relieves the publisher of the obligation to produce an accurate report. I mean, as it was pointed out, in Edwards, there was an accurate report of the allegation. Also, in the April case, which is relied on by the appellant, there was an accurate report of the allegation.
But I think the argument is further in terms of the subjective knowledge of the reporter. Do you agree that in this case, a reporter could, under the neutral reporting chapter, could this reporter, under that doctrine, could this reporter use her subjective knowledge of James Young? I would advantage.
Well, I would ask that this court not adopt a subjective test. In essence, a subjective test is going to give a reporter free rein to print whatever they want. It encourages a reporter to be accurate in recording and encourages a reporter to guess at facts. Essentially, if you apply a subjective standard, that's applying the malice requirement to private individuals, because the only way to prove that a reporter did not believe in the facts is to show that the facts were false and the reporter knew that at the time of publication. So in essence, you would be applying the malice standard by adopting the holding in Edwards. And U.S. Supreme Court specifically rejected the application of the malice standard in the Time Inc. versus Firestone case on page 453. Also, if you adopt the neutral reportage doctrine of Edwards, it runs contrary to United States Supreme Court holdings, holding that there is no First Amendment protection for false statements of fact. In essence, what the neutral reportage doctrine does is give First Amendment protection for false statements of fact. Therefore, I would urge that you not adopt the subjective standard of the neutral reportage doctrine. Finally, on the issue of public figure, the appellant argues that general fame or notoriety is enough to render a person a public figure. If you look at the Gertz opinion, page 352, it requires a showing of general fame or notoriety in the community and pervasive involvement in affairs of society. So there's two requirements, not just one. Also, if you look at the Time Inc. versus Firestone case, page 454, the appellant is arguing that as long as something's in the public interest, then the person is a public figure. But that argument was specifically rejected by the United States Supreme Court on page 454 of the Time Inc. opinion. We would urge that you adopt and affirm the Court of Appeals holding, finding that there's liability for false statements of fact, that would promote the policy that newspapers must accurately report the facts. Liability provides a check on the media. Essentially, civil liability is the only check of private individuals for inaccurate statements made by the media. It would also reaffirm the principle established by the United States Supreme Court that there is no First Amendment protection for false statements of fact. When a media makes a false statement of fact, there should be liability. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Roof. Mr. Panza, you've used your time, so you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Justice Moore. I'd like to point out one thing about this correction. I do not believe, I believe that 2317.05, the only way theoretically someone would lose that protection is if they failed to publish a correction, a written correction submitted by Mr. Young in this case. And I believe if you read 2739.13, the statute that he cited, that also requires a failure to republish a written statement submitted to the newspaper by Mr. Young in this case. As I've already pointed out to the court, Mr. Young never submitted any written statement for correction to be published. The correction that appeared in the paper 2 days later was a submission that the newspaper made on its own.
It came, didn't he call, as I recall?
He did make a phone call.
And apparently it came in response to his phone call.
He did make a phone call.
No, I think that's picky. I should have asked that of the appellee, but you might look on page 13 of your brief, Mr. Rowe. When you report the statute, 2317.05, starting on page 12, and then you reproduce it, when you get to, unless it is proved that the same was published maliciously or that defendant has refused, you leave something out of the statute. That can happen, can't it? Look at the top of page 13. If you don't quote the statute accurately, you left out the word in.
I didn't add anything in that was not accurate.
The last 2 points I'd like to make is that there is no evidence of malice anywhere in the record, and there was no extra comment by the reporter when she reproduced the record, which would be an exception to the reporting. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.